You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome Master Sommelier Carlton McCoy. In this episode, we'll talk to Carlton about representation in the wine industry, his journey from CCAP to CEO, and we'll hear Carlton's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia once said, "Therein lies the science of the experienced wine connoisseur. The more you drink and think upon it, the more you'll know." While jokes abound about Julia having had too much to drink on TV, always a misperception, she was naturally goofy. She was anything but silly when it came to wine appreciation. In fact, her love of wine, which extended well beyond drinking it to the craft and people who make it, was something Julia discovered in France and learned about from her husband, Paul. As Julia's fame grew, she made it her mission to advocate for the California wine industry alongside her good friend, Robert Mondavi. As much as she loved a great French wine, she also believed in America producing wines to rival Europe. The fruits of her advocacy and the hard work of many others working in California vineyards, wineries, and tasting rooms is that California's wines, especially those from Napa and Sonoma, as well as Santa Barbara, are now globally prized. Someone equally passionate about California wine is Carlton McCoy. Carlton is CEO of Lawrence Wine Estates in Napa Valley, one of the youngest ever and only the second African-American to earn certification as a Master Sommelier. He is also a graduate of the Careers in Culinary Arts program, also known as CCAP, a program the foundation has supported for many years. We spoke to fellow CCAP alum, pastry chef Lashita Perry, in episode 149. Raised in Washington, D.C., Carlton won a CCAP cooking competition, garnering a scholarship to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. After graduating from the CIA, Carlton worked at some of America's top restaurants, like Thomas Keller's Per Se, Marcus Samuelson's Aquavit, and Tom Colicchio's Kraft Steak. While working for Eric Siebold's Citizen in D.C., Carlton resolved to forge a career in wine. In 2011, he joined the Little Nell in Aspen, earning his Master Sommelier certification in 2013, and as wine director there, oversaw its 20,000-bottle cellar. In 2018, he moved to Napa Valley, becoming president and CEO at Heights Cellar, the first African-American to run a major winery. After it was acquired by Galen Lawrence Jr., Carlton teamed with Lawrence to form Lawrence Wine Estates, which includes Heights Cellar, Stony Hill Vineyard, Burgess Cellars, and other Napa Valley vineyards. The business also includes Demen Estates, representing an international collective of wineries. Equally passionate about giving back, Carlton, together with Tahira Habibi and Akimi DeBose, launched the Roots Fund to address a lack of diversity in the wine industry. It provides resources and financial support through educational scholarships, wine education, mentors, and job placement, much like CCAP, by the way. He's a member of the Court of Master Sommeliers Diversity Committee and serves on the boards of the James Beard Foundation and Culinary Institute of America. You may recognize him from Nomad, a six-part CNN docuseries where Carlton takes viewers on a global exploration of place-based culture. He joins us today to tell us about his journey from CCAP to CEO and how he's working to make the wine industry more inclusive. Welcome to the podcast, Carlton.
Hello, hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I live in Napa Valley. Life can only be so bad.
Yes, when the sun is shining in California, it's an amazing place to be.
It's what we call the sunshine tax. It's worth it.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah, as someone now in Southern California, you play off that what it's like to be here and how expensive it is to live here.
I tell my friends all the time, I says, Carlton, do you want to try to buy a house in Texas or Nevada and you're playing these games? I says, look, I'd rather pay the extra 15% and wake up every day overlooking Napa Valley, drive to work this way, then, you know, I only got so many days, you know, and where you want to spend your days, you know, in a suburb of Austin, or do you want to live in Napa Valley? You know what I mean? It's like, it's worth the 10-15%.
Well, since I don't know exactly how many listeners we have in Texas, I'm just going to say it's all about trade-offs, right? And everybody makes their own trade-offs.
No, I there's a lot of places in the world, and I've been very blessed to travel to a lot of places that I'd love to visit, but just for me, I wouldn't live there. There's a lot of international places where I'd love to go spend 3-4 nights, but I can't wait to get back home. You know, there's a difference. They're great places. Just like in the Napa Valley. There's a lot of people who would hate to live here.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, they just would. I don't know why, but I mean, I'm sure they could find a reason.
Well, and it's all relative to, you know, sort of what kind of employment you have. Because, like, you know, Manhattan is a fantastic place to live if you're fabulously wealthy. If you're on a fixed income, it's one of the hardest places in the world.
Oh, New York, it's only a great city if you're wealthy.
Well,
I'm telling you, I lived there for 2 years. I go, this is insane.
Well, now I know. Yeah, now we know you have clear opinions on this. Let's rewind a little bit because I wanted to ask you about CCAP and how that kind of set you up for a course or did or didn't. Maybe you'll tell me I'm wrong for what is now such an accomplished, still at a young age, career in food and wine.
Yeah, I mean, CCAP is one, it's Careers of Culinary Arts program. It was started by a very, very generous man, Richard Grossman. And Grossman he's become very much like a father figure to a lot of people who maybe weren't raised in very stable households with a strong male figure. And he's continued to be that person in my life, one of those people in my life to this day. And he started this organization very much inspired by, you know, I'd say the titans of the era, and still are the titans in my eyes, like Julia Child, Jacques Pepin. It was really that heyday, and he really admired their commitment to teaching Americans, specifically at the time, how to be connected with food. Is something that wasn't a nuisance that you had to do when you came home, but it was an honor to be able to work with ingredients and craft great food for your family and friends. And he saw a need for that, especially in the urban communities, where he saw, look, these are not jobs that pay an enormous amount of money. You never become wealthy as a cook, but it was far more than what you were going to make, you know, not having that opportunity. And, you know, years later, he told me, he says, look, I was going to these communities and these kids knew far more about cooking beautifully flavored soulful cuisine than any kid from my family. He says, so they were sort of, you were almost training your entire life to be a great cook. That's what you wanted to do. And I met him when I was 16. And very lost, like a lot of 16-year-olds are, but that's a far more dangerous era in your life when you're in a place like Southeast DC. The risks are much higher. And he, you know, he put me on a path to, you know, to be where I am now. And that was very much, you know, if you can look at my life and say there's one point in which things changed, it was then. It was meeting Richard Grossman.
Wow, that's really powerful. And obviously what he's accomplished is really admirable. I think what's interesting in what you said is a lot of what he and CCAP are providing is access. It's not so much that no young kids from underprivileged backgrounds know about cooking. As you said, a lot of them might come from families that are very connected to food and cooking, but it's also about kind of bridging that divide between, for lack of a better term, the rules and the way the mainstream or particularly fine dining restaurant mm-hmm. industry works and yeah. how you would ever access that if you'd never heard of the CIA before.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. It's you know, I tell people all the time, You know, I went from never knowing that being a chef was an actual career, you know, to, you know, being a teaching assistant at the CIA 2 years later. So what it tells you is that the barriers that exist, a lot of it are just exposure, right? Is one big part of it. Is you live in a neighborhood that doesn't have chefs. I didn't know what the word chef was, right? And you know, what CCAP really aspired to do is take kids that, you know, if given the opportunity, they felt could excel. Because they don't do the work for you. They just go, look, if you're a sharp kid and you want to work hard and you have a sort of basic passion for food. And I was always a pudgy kid. I love to eat. You know, I lived my entire life in the kitchen with my grandmother. It's the best part of my day always. And they would give you this opportunity, but then you had to take advantage of it. And just as easily, it'd be taken away. You had to perform in school when you got there. You can get a special class, you know, just because you were from, you know, an underserved neighborhood. So part of it was just exposure. And once I knew, I was like, man, people can make money doing this. This is wild. You know what I mean? I've been cooking all my life. I was like, I could be making money all this time.
Was your grandmother a caterer though?
Yeah. So in the Black community, understand there's a lot of, it's a very tribal community, which is what I actually love about my community is we sort of just make do, we support each other a lot in that community. So, you know, whether it was birthday parties or some sort of church event or a neighborhood, you know, my grandmother was that person that would, she would cater. We had a commercial kitchen in the back of the church and we would cook these big, pretty large events. You know, when you think about like most families never cook for more than six people, you know, maybe 20 on a big Thanksgiving, you know, gathering. We would cook for 200-300 people. And I was a part of that at a very young age. And it taught you a lot about timing and execution and timelines and how to work with people. And, you know, it was very intense. And it was all my grandmother and my aunts. So I was always the only guy in the kitchen.
But that wasn't, so it was sort of a community-based thing though. And it, so it wasn't the main way she made her living.
It was one of the ways. But, you know, me and my grandmother was a very generous person. So sometimes she'd do it for free because that's just how she was. But yeah, she made money doing it. And it was typically, I was the only guy in the kitchen. I was the only male. It was my grandmother, her sisters and me, you know, and my sister.
Wow. So you, I think unusually for people who are at a high level or even at a medium level in the wine industry, have a very solid background in food and cooking and being on the line. When did you kind of do this transition to like, I'm going to be about wine and food's going to be a little bit, or cooking as a chef is going to be more in the background?
Well, you know, I took culinary school very seriously and I loved learning specifically about, you know, classical French cuisine. I was, to this day, I'm still very, very passionate about it. I spent years of my life studying it. And when I had the opportunity to actually start to visit these countries, I realized that there was little to no separation between food and wine culture and industries. Typically, actually, winemakers are some of the best cooks, you know, and also these classical French dishes that were engineered were, you know, a lot of times they were engineered in the wine region, right? So America, because we're a new nation, we haven't learned that connection yet. And also France, they have regions all over the country, right? So whether you're in the Loire Valley and Champagne and Alsace, and, you know, every region has wine. In the US, we pretty much champion California, Oregon wine, and that's just about it. So, you know, if you live in Tennessee, what's your connection with viticulture? You know, so for me, it was once I actually started to experience them together, I realized that they were one and the same. And I took my first job in the dining room in New York and started to learn about hospitality and started studying wine. I put the same emphasis on it. I really, really loved it. It was just a continuation. I'm aspiring to have this career change. It was continuation of that study of you know, food and wine culture.
So I was curious, I was just thinking about some of the reasons also that you ended up working front of house instead of in the kitchen were monetary, which then related to you not coming from a privileged background. I was curious to hear more from you about the Roots Fund and whether that was really born out of your experience, because let's be frank, I still think we we would agree, but tell me if I'm wrong, that the wine industry is still pretty elitist and white dominated. It's maybe changed a tiny bit, but not a lot.
Sure, but I'd say it's not exclusive to the wine industry. I'd say an industry that it was involved with a luxury good, and wine is ironically still looked at as a luxury good, although 80% of the wine in the US is under $30 that's consumed. It's probably actually under 25. So it's really not a luxury good, but it's marketed that way. We're always dominated by that demographic. And for me, I was raised in a way where, you know, being mixed race, you were always sort of caught in between the different sides of the coin. And I really just tried to be myself in the situation. And if I was passionate about it, then people embraced me. And I worked very hard. And I didn't really have as many of those hurdles once I proved myself, just like anyone else. You know, I saw the opportunity and to learn and to learn about different parts of the world and how people live. And I understood that those barriers existed, but I was not going to allow that to hinder me in any way.
And so tell us more about what the Roots Fund is doing or what your approach has been.
Yeah, I mean, it's 100% modeled off of CCAP. It is a copy and paste of the concept.
Sure Richard is just fine with.
Yeah, 100%. We told him. So,
I'm sure he was flattered.
Yeah, he was. I mean, Akemi DeVos, who's the executive director, was also a CCAP student. Uh-huh. And so when I talked to her, it was like, hey, look, this is what we want to do. And it was model CCAP, take out careers, probably culinary arts, and then put in careers through wine, you know, and like you can model it that way, you get it. And it was looking through the lens of what we discussed in the beginning, which was, if you could just expose people in these various communities, whether it be Latinx, African American, Native American, Asian American, communities that typically don't have a large presence in the wine industry, about what the potential is and where they could work in those industries, then you would pique people's interest, you know, at a far more rapid pace than if obviously they never knew it existed before. And then it was about raising funds to try to fund some educational opportunities for students that needed it. Not every student that comes from a community of color is from a poor neighborhood, but for those who didn't have the financial means to do it, we would help fund those, and that's what we do. And the last is job placement. So we try to use the influence we have in various aspects of the wine industry to get them in the room. They've got to interview, they've got to get the job, but we at least get them in the room, and we try to find opportunities for them. And it's been wildly successful. And a lot of that, frankly, has to do with Akemi and her ability to I'd say build it at a very rapid pace, much faster than I ever thought we could.
That's great to hear. Are there any examples either directly from the Roots Fund, which I know is relatively new, or even just where you're seeing either things that you're pleased to see or excited to see in terms of the wine industry diversifying? Obviously, you yourself are one example, but I was just curious of others that are starting to materialize, or if you're seeing the change accelerate.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we're seeing major, major change. I mean, the industry has absolutely embraced it. You know, whether that is for genuine reasons or for economic reasons, to me, I actually don't care. The result's the same. And you're absolutely seeing this embrace of communities that typically, I'd say, we didn't have a seat at the table for a very long time. In some cases, there were barriers that were there, and then in some cases, there were just communities that, again, were not engaged with wine. So now that they are, it's like, well, great, now you're embraced, and this is another voice at the table. And it's been fantastic to see how fast it's changed. And you know, we look at through the lens of every other industry, whether it be fashion or music. The more voices at the table, the more dynamic and exciting the industry is.
Gotcha. So I was also curious that you obviously, or maybe not obviously, people haven't actually read or heard that much about it before, but it's a huge amount of work to become a master sommelier. As I mentioned, you know, you're one of the youngest and the second African-American to do it, which is also, though, to say that not that many people accomplish it out of the whole human population. So it's a very, very difficult thing to achieve, but you've kind of pivoted more to the business side of the wine business. So are you still marrying the two up, or is it kind of like been there, done that, moved on?
No, it's all in the same. I think that experience has helped me be a better visionary for what we're doing here, is understanding, in my opinion, what great wine is, understanding luxury goods, understanding what the end consumer is looking for and how to sell it. It's critical. I mean, it's the part that often is missing on this side of the business. They tend to, you know, you work in this sort of vacuum of this industry noise of what you think you should be doing, but you're not out in the industry talking about what people are actually demanding. And we found a very interesting niche here in the Napa Valley for what we're interested in, which is producing wines that are typically much more elegant, lighter, more terroir driven than what had been produced in the last, call it 20 or 30 years. You know, you have to remember that in the 60s and 70s, when Napa was really finding itself, they were making very elegant, really pure wines. And then the modern era, the Robert Parker era hit, and the wines got, you know, big and massive. And, you know, and that those were not the wines that attracted me to Napa Valley, or attracted even the Lawrence family to Napa. It was the 60s and 70s wines that we really loved, and even the early 80s. So we really built an entire enterprise around a structure and a flavor profile that we really love, which are, again, more elegant, more pure wines that have more complexity and more of a terroir expression. And that perspective and that philosophy is 100% a derivative of my experience as a sommelier.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's the idea. And certainly the criticism that Europeans like to sling at American wines is they're over-oaked or too big and hit you over the head. And right, that's kind of where Napa and Sonoma sort of drifted.
Yeah.
And then that was the sort of backlash, if you will.
Yeah, I agree. And they're not, I mean, again, it's all a matter of taste, right? And you know, I have never once stated that what I enjoy drinking should be the taste of all. And that's where I think people get wrong. It's, you know, there are so many people in the world that drink wine now and drink quality wine that you can, in this market, be what you want to be. And there will be, a very motivated buyer who's excited to drink those wines. It's about finding your crowd. And that's really what we've endeavored to do. And, we, you know, just like our approach to, you know, I'd say most things in the world is, you know, my existence and who I am does not diminish, you know, who you are in any way. It's not a competition. And I think that's a metaphor for a lot of issues we have around the world in general.
That is an excellent point. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with more from Master Sommelier and CEO of Lawrence Wine Estates, Carlton McCoy. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new series on Heritage Radio Network called The Culinary Call Sheet, where we give a peek into the back kitchen of culinary media. I'm your host, April Jones.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Bresnitz. Part of why we started this show was to offer an unofficial mentorship for anyone who is interested in learning about all aspects of food and video, whether that's TV, social media, online, or just something you want to do for fun.
Absolutely. What was once niche or a little silly, as I'm sure you remember, Darren, when we started out.
Yes, ma'am.
Has now become such a massive playing field for so many creatives using food as the medium.
It's something that has driven us professionally and personally for so many years. What excites me the most about this show is that we're going to sit down with some of the industry leaders to hear how they made it and what drew them into this industry.
With 20 years in the culinary production game ourselves, we're hoping we can give, through these conversations, an insider's view into personal stories from the field, as well as an in-depth behind-the-scenes look into some of the most popular food programming in today's evolving culinary media landscape.
We'll be covering everything from how to style your food, to how to license IP, to developing your own ideas, and some tips from the masters of how to host your own show.
Yeah, it's a little bit of conversation, how to, and how do you do the things that you do in culinary media, which I'm so excited about. I love so many of the guests that are coming on this season. We have talent from Food Network, from Bice Media, Eater, Refinery 29.
We've met some of the best people in the world, both in front of and behind the camera. And we're bringing them all together to share their stories, their delicious adventure, and their unique journey into this crazy world.
So to be the first to hear our episodes when they launch this fall, go to wherever podcasts are streaming and hit subscribe, and make sure to give us a follow at the Culinary Call Sheet on Instagram.
Welcome back. We're talking to Master Sommelier, host of CNN's Nomad, and CEO of Lawrence Wine Estates, Carlton McCoy. So Nomad, which is the travelogue TV series you created and hosted for CNN, it kind of took you on this cultural expedition around the world. And I was just curious how that experience and then whatever public response you've received from the show, is that impacted how you're navigating the wine business we were just talking about, or even how people respond to you as a wine professional?
Yeah, I think I've never been one to sort of, I see, live inside a predictable box of how I should operate. And I think it further confuses people as to who I am and what I do. you try to encapsulate the titles and articles and so forth. And it's like Carlton McCoy, you know, Master Sommelier, former chef, CEO, host. And it's like, okay, well, you know, the goal is that they one day just say my name and it'll just mean whatever it means to whoever's listening. That's what it is. It's, I think the world is much too exciting to just stick to one sort of little bubble. So I think the show, I think, personified that when we tried to navigate a lot of cultural pillars. So food was a big part of it because it's been a big part of my life, but also, you know, touch on when it was appropriate in the country and beverage. And then it was a lot of, you know, dipping our toes in the water of some social issues and you know, religion and sports and art and all the things that make a place in the world very exciting and unique. And, you know, it was just a reminder of how interconnected what we do in the wine industry is to other cultural pillars in the world. It's a reminder of that. And it's really helped us look at our estates through that lens of what else are we connecting to? Or are we living in this little bubble of wine? Or are we not finding ways to connect it to the art world, you know, to great chefs, you know, to, you know, whatever it is, like, are we connecting to the rest of the world, or are we doing what most of the wine world does, which is live in this little, its own little bubble, which is very common in the wine industry.
I think that's a great point, because I'm struck by that. And you mentioned that before, that when you were able to travel in France in particular, how much in European countries like France and Italy and Spain, wine is part of regular culture. It's not this little niche thing that's a luxury good that only certain people access. And it seems like that's where you connect up what you want to do with Nomad, and it relates to your job at Lawrence Wine Estates in that looking at wine as part of everyday culture, not this specialist thing that's lying out here.
Correct. And I think we often look at it that way because we're still a new wine drinking nation in the US. You know, we're still getting used to, you know, how does it live in our day-to-day lives? And because of that, we see it as this sort of isolated thing sitting over here while we live our lives. We're in other nations that have been drinking wine, you know, for centuries, sometimes, you know, even more. It's just what it finds itself in everyday life, you know, on the lunch table, on the dinner table, on the picnic. It's what we grab.
Yeah, I was struck by that too, because people may get confused because I say I'm like originally from several places because I'm a native Californian, but I was raised in the Midwest. And I think that, and for a good part of my upbringing, so I'm like close to being a native Midwest, yeah. But I'm not technically. But I think when you are
you have a different perspective than if you only are come from the coast and don't really have any, you know, direct experience. And I was interested that Lawrence Wine Estates actually has that Midwestern Southeast kind of connection. And I was just wondering for you, if that also kind of informs this perspective, like you were saying, that in Tennessee, the wine industry is not really part of people's daily consciousness. Do you feel like that's giving you guys a unique advantage, or you're approaching things differently as a result?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just, everything's about perspective. You know, because I've lived in so many places and been able to travel so much, you just start to realize that a lot of this little like local, I'd say bubble-minded tribalism that exists is all engineered. It's not reality. That you have to take inspiration from everywhere and see the world as a global market, especially in today's world, and how you're going to approach things. It has to be authentic, it has to be real, but it has to connect to other cultural aspects in the world to be successful. And, you know, we're really fortunate to have a number of people from our company from all walks of life. And that's made from very exciting and dynamic meetings and brainstorming sessions and how we approach things. And we'll always do that. We'll always be that type of enterprise.
And do you think that there is a radically different approach to it from people from the Southeast, or actually what you've learned is there is more commonality than there is difference?
Well, America it's incredibly, probably more local than people like to think. Is depending on the part of the country, and it's a completely different planet, the way people think and the way they approach things. So I try to like challenge myself to get out of any sort of travel minded mindset. It's saying with our business is we're going down this path. It's like, okay, are we doing this because it's sort of the way things have been done, or are we doing this because this is like our perspective and our lens? Like, can we change that filter and see a different way? Like, it's always a challenge. It's a ever present desire to challenge yourself to look through a new lens that maybe not be your own, right? It's a challenge, but you have to do it.
That's a fair point. Yeah. So going bigger picture, I was just curious, given everything we've discussed and all these different perspectives that you bring to the table, both in your past lives and in your present, I was curious what your impression is of, you know, we're entering this fierce period of the climate change discussion. We're also entering a very strong period of a lot of evolution in dining out, which is driven by the economic shifts and changes. So what's your take right now on where you see, and you can speak to it from a Lawrence Wine Estates perspective or your own, just like, where's the wine industry, particularly American wine industry, headed?
I think everyone's trying to figure that out right now. You know, there is the sort of company by company efforts, and I think we try to do what we can here. We have quickly become the largest biodynamic farming company in all of California. We have 650 planted acres that are all farmed with biodynamic practices, which it pretty much takes away any chemical uses in the vineyard at all, and it's all a very natural farming. We till the soils very rarely. We try to use very little water as possible. So we do things in our company to counteract that. But obviously, that's still a very small effort in the grand scheme of the entire wine industry around the world. But because we're an agricultural business first, we are very aware of the effects of climate change. You know, viticulture is one of the oldest continuous forms of agriculture where there are actually records. Right, so we actually have records of temperatures and rainfall and harvest dates and all those things that you can use to measure differences in climate and in temperature. And so for us, we've seen that there is a difference, and really what we're trying to do is assess what those are and how do we mitigate them. But it's a global issue, right? You can only do so much yourself. That there are much bigger industries that have an impact on us than just what we do. As if, you know, the whole, you know, wine industry decides to dramatically change how it operates, it still is like a drop in a massive bucket of world industries that need to make a change. Hearing news, as we've heard in the last couple weeks, of a very small percentage of countries have made commitments to changing the way they operate, not actually following through with it. You go, well, we can only do so much, but the world has to make adjustments for it actually to make any measurable change. We're very much a small industry at the mercy of these much larger industries.
And do you see, I was going to ask you that about globally versus California or the Pacific Northwestern wine industry. Do you see that the challenges actually are more similar across the global, European and Southern Hemisphere wine industries as in California? Or do you think there's distinct differences in what each area is kind of facing?
They're all unique. And I think that's important to frame it as climate change and not global warming, because there's some areas that are colder and rainier than they used to be, and some that are a lot warmer and drier than they ever were before. But either way, everyone is noticing pretty massive shifts. And what we try to do here is there's preventative measures, but also we still have to farm every day. So we're looking at different ways to be able to farm to mitigate some of these. For instance, when's the last time we had a 2 years in a row of proper rain in California? We haven't, right? But we still have to farm vineyards in a way that preserves water, because we also only have so much groundwater to be able to use. So all these things we take into consideration as we're operating, because you have to. We make investments and commitments to own these estates for generations, and you're setting them up to be able to produce great wines for centuries. So if you're going to do that, you've got to work around what you have, right? And farm in a way that is conducive for what you currently have. Unfortunately, it's so inconsistent, you don't know what you're going to get next year. But it used to be a little bit more predictable.
Well, and I think that's an interesting confluence of biodynamic. And for people who don't know, it has some similarities to being organic, but it's less about certification and it's more about practices like no-till and not using pesticides. But it's kind of an interesting look at, I think maybe 10 or 15 years ago, it would have been considered more woo-woo and just environmentalist. But
I think they would call it witchcraft back then. I mean, it's almost, even when we were, we purchased Hyde Cellar. Hyde Cellar was one of the first wineries in the Napa Valley to ever go fully organic. And at the time, it was looked upon as, is this weird thing? Why would you do that? We look back and go, okay, that was the right thing to do. Now you're seeing far more wineries go organic, even though not as many as probably should and could do it. So, it's always trying to be ahead of things and do what you think is right. And, people will catch up when they catch up. You really can't run your business that way.
Well, and I was going to say that I think what you also just described is going biodynamic is an actual economic response to these climate issues as they affect agriculture. It's not only a kind of conceptual, like we need to be more environmentally conscious. It business-wise makes sense given the variability.
Yeah, I mean, it's the dangerous part is when people try to deny it. It's okay to say, like, I recognize it's happening, but I don't agree that that's the solution. That I can live with, actually. Then we have a debate. But where we have major issues is when people still deny it's an issue. And it's scary. It's very dangerous. It's like watching your house burn down and go, well, there's no fire here. It's sort of what we're seeing. That's really scary. And we still have people in the wine industry here. Or, that's the song they're singing. We just try to, I'm not one for a fight over these things. For me, I'd rather, we can have a conversation and then, we go back to operating the way we are. We try to push things forward, right? We always want to be the leaders in this industry in every way. And that means that sometimes it takes people a little while to jump on board to get it. But that is, that's the case with every progressive movement.
So on that note, I also wanted to ask you about the sort of differences, because I think this is a newer thing in Napa and Sonoma. It was, to me, always about sort of these curation of these exclusive and pedigreed labels. And there's been a lot more movement and consolidation because it's a very expensive and risky business. But I was curious sort of how Lawrence Wine Estates, which is now a collection of different domains and vineyards, and then you also have Domaine Estates. And are they totally different businesses, or how do they complement each other?
Yeah, so Lawrence Wine Estates is really it's a collection of wineries that are focused on natural farming, lower intervention winemaking, and more elegant terroir-driven wines. Domaine Estates is a California-based sales and marketing agency that represents those wineries, but also has a much larger portfolio of wineries that it represents. It's run completely independently. I oversee all of them, but we have team members who directly manage those companies. And they have two very different reasons for being. In Lawrence Wine Estates, those are actual producing wineries. Domaine Estates doesn't produce any wine. They buy wine from those wineries and other imported wines and represents them on the global market.
And does sort of sitting over the two kind of give you also a unique perspective, or they
Absolutely.
Tend to?
Yeah, it helps a lot. It helps me to guide decisions on both as we strategize. I mean, right now is a big time for us. We strategize. Technically, here we have 10 companies. So we build forecast and budget for all 10 every year. And some of that is intertwined. And some of the goals of one has to be sacrificed for the goals of the other. And it's my job to be that sort of referee to do what is in the best interest of each company so none of them fails.
And so is Domaine actually also an importer, or mainly it's an exporter of Lawrence wines?
It exports Lawrence wines, but we also have an import portfolio, including some really incredible wines from all over Europe. We just signed on the entire Mazze family portfolio, and they have estates all over Italy. We have Le Grand Champagne, we have Domaine de Monti in Burgundy. We have the Morlaix family in Sancerre. Yeah, I mean, the list really goes on. So it's growing very, very quickly. And you may have heard this morning, I don't know if you're plugged into wine media, but we just announced the acquisition of Chateau Lascombe, which is a second growth in the village of Margaux in Bordeaux. We actually finally closed the deal on that. So we're now the owners of that. So that just adds to the excitement of my life, but also the excitement for the entire team.
Congratulations. So is this the first entree then on the Lawrence Wine Estate side of owning a vineyard outside of the U.S.?
Yes, it's the first. And we felt really confident that this is, it was the right move for us and, the type of estate that we really liked, which is, make really beautiful classically structured wines. But the older ownership was a much larger company. And we came in as a group that was rooted in the wine industry. And we feel that we can really help Lasco move into the next layer of evolution, if you will.
Wow, that's all exciting. Well, we need to sort of wrap up, but I felt like we couldn't have all of this business conversation without talking a little bit about wine. And I was just going to ask you, like, to call out something that you're excited about that you've been drinking lately that's kind of right for this time of year.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is it's fall and here, and it starts to get a little bit cold, and you see the food get a touch richer. And when that happens, you start to go a bit south. And I love the wines of the Rhone Valley, especially the Syrah based wines. Mm-hmm. And Saint-Joseph is one of my favorite villages because the wines tend to be very mineral and sort of crunchy and but have great depth, and they use a touch less new oak, which I really prefer. And but also the price for Saint-Joseph is a little bit lower than Corvette or even some Cournasse. And they can be really, really fantastic wines, and I actually like them just a little cooler in cellar temperature, and they're really beautiful wines. Like what we reach for at home all the time.
That's great to know. We'll look out for that. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll hear Carlton's Julia moment. Let us know what you think of today's show. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or you can tweet us @juliachildjcf. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. Carlton, what's your Julia moment?
It was really interesting. I even when I was a kid, I loved watching cooking shows, and there were two cooking shows at the time that I would always have on. One was, it's still to this day, probably my favorite cooking show, is Two Fat Ladies, which is an epic show. And then
for those who don't know, you're not making a slur. That's literally the name of the show.
Correct. And then Julia's show, which was, I'd say more entertaining, just her personality. So when I went to culinary school, I was maybe a year and a half in, and Julia actually visited the school. She was much older at the time. And when I got to meet her, what really struck me was we were in this era. It was the first big era of like the celebrity chef, and we always felt that they were sort of like these untouchable, like, you know, really intense people, and they were celebrities. And what I found, and then what I felt from Julia, was this extreme approachability and graciousness that was not always modeled in a lot of the celebrity chefs at the time, who were really focused on their brand, and there was everything that comes with being a celebrity. At that time, it was a big deal. And she was just so hospitable and so easy to connect with. And there was this this genuine humanity about her that really struck me. And it made me love the show more, because you say, okay, she's the same person on television as she is in real life. And I was just a culinary student at the time. And, you know, those sort of moments really become what you feed off of when you deal with difficult times in the industry, is the people who motivate you, inspire you. And it's not one thing that she did. It's just what she represented and who she was. This person who was at the very top of her game and was this iconic figure was still the same person. It hadn't changed her. She understood how incredible our industry was and its ability to connect people, and that really was always about people. And she did that. She taught Americans how to laugh and enjoy being in the kitchen and ensure that it wasn't a chore. And she just was the same person. I was just really taken back by that. My expectation was very different.
That's lovely. And I was struck by, in our entire conversation, Carlton, how thrilled Julia would have been to hear about all of this progress and sophistication and complexity and exciting opportunity, as well as in what you just described with this French vineyard acquisition, this melding of these worlds that yeah. She loved. So I think she'd be smiling.
Fantastic.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Our pleasure. And thanks everyone for listening. If you want to keep up with Carlton, he's at Carlton McCoy on Instagram and Twitter. For all the latest from the foundation, it's at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm T. Shulkin on Twitter. And make sure to follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram to be in the know. The SBCE sneak preview event at Maddie's Tavern in San Ynez Valley sold out in 48 hours. You'll have to look for the next one. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at GBH, thanks to my co-producer of the foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Armin Spengen. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. Downloads available soon after, wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.